Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Good afternoon and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. We also welcome our radio and internet audiences, and we invite everyone to visit us online at www.commonwealthclub.org. My name is Dr. Patrick O'Reilly. I'm chair of the Psychology Forum here at the Commonwealth Club. And I am genuinely delighted to introduce today's speaker, Ms. Cheryl Crowder. Cheryl Crowder, MFT, is a psychotherapist with nearly 40 years of experience in the field of psychology. She integrates her experience as a psychotherapist with her personal journey as a cancer survivor. She began working with people in various stages of cancer diagnosis after her own experiences and has presented numerous talks and workshops on living with the uncertainty of life-threatening illness. A former board member of the Women's Cancer Resource Center in Oakland, she continues to work as a therapist in their free therapy program. She has a private practice in San Francisco and in Albany. Her book, Surviving the Storm, A Workshop for Telling Your Cancer Story, was published and released by Oxford University in March of 2017. Not only does her book key in on the challenges with post-cancer life, it is a practical workshop which helps the survivors and their families find their own voice and their own path to a better and joyful life. Knowing how liberating it is for cancer patients to tell their own story, Ms. Crowder strongly believes that focusing on and helping others has been an important part of her recovery. There will be a time following her talk for questions and answers. If you have any questions, you can fill out the question cards and I'll collect them and read them out to her. And following her talk, she'll be delighted to chat with anybody who wants to speak with her here, and she will be also happy to sign her books, which are for sale in the foyer. So please welcome Ms. Crowder.
I'll take that. Thank you. Thank you. So what would you do if you knew you only had one more day, one last week, or a month to live? There's a philosophy that suggests if we live each day as if it were our last, we become more alive. We take more risks. We might discover what it is that we want to do with whatever time we've been given. You may shed your familiar, your accepted skin in favor of becoming who you've always wanted to be, or who you truly are. And sometimes workshops pose the theoretical question, what would you do if you had a year to live? And people pay money to spend a weekend imagining that they are dying so that they can reflect upon what they might do differently, what choices they might make, what dreams they might want to make come true. You know, some of us didn't take that course as an elective. But for the rest of your life, you're going to be in that class. And as I look out at you, I know that some of you have traveled some pretty rough miles to get here tonight. And I know that you have a story to tell about what went on for you as you walked along those miles. Because what's true is that after finishing treatment for cancer, many of us just don't feel finished with what has just happened to us. We feel a need to speak about our experiences so that we can better understand them and begin to integrate them into our lives as we move forward. What I've witnessed is a great need for cancer survivors to tell their stories, to tell the real story of the storm that is cancer, as well as the ravages of its treatments. Being met and listened to while you tell your story is healing in and of itself. And when someone really listens to you as you paint the pictures of your experiences, you know, you can find a certain relief and a freedom in being able to release everything that you have carried within you. As I look out here again at all of you, I know that you have a story to tell about your odyssey. Yours is a story that began without you knowing where it was going to take you. Because, I want to get real here, you didn't put having cancer on your to-do list. But here you are, and here I am. And it's really good to be here, and I'm really honored to be here tonight to share some stories with all of you. But now, we're going to go back in time, because Surviving the Storm, a workbook for telling your cancer story, begins with my story. So, it's March 27th, 2007, and I'm waiting for a call from my breast surgeon about my biopsy. My husband is up at the ballpark watching my son pitch a game. It's a beautiful, warm California spring afternoon, and I'm really wanting to get out. But I need to take a call. Hello? Yeah, it's Cheryl, uh-huh. Yes, hi, Dr. Greif. Well, I'm okay, yeah, are you? Oh, good, uh-huh. Where am I? I'm at home. Uh-oh. Yeah, uh-huh. Oh, uh-huh, yeah, no, I'm sitting down. This is going badly. You have the results of my biopsy, uh-huh, yeah. I have cancer. All of you remember the moment you first heard those words. You have cancer. Where were you? What were you doing? It only takes a moment to receive that news. Yet from that moment on, your world is changed forever. And, you know, it just feels so unreal. I mean, I was sitting there. I had to get a moment, try and get up from the chair, get the feeling back in my feet, catch my breath as I began the walk up to the ballpark. And I'm telling myself, hold it together, hold it together. Gasping for air, I climb into those rickety stands and I sit next to my husband. And the moment he looks at me, he knows. It's just so unreal. I mean, kids are attempting to play baseball. Parents are screaming at them from the stands. And we just leave the ballpark and we walk wordlessly up the street. And I'm still trying to get the feeling back in my feet. And my poor husband, he's talking anxiously. We're going to do this. We can get it together. We've done this before. It's going to be okay. And I feel like I'm in a wind tunnel. It's like, what is he talking about? What is he saying to me? And then, just like Alice down the rabbit hole, I slip into some dark, surreal world. And everything just goes blank. Well, so the next thing I remember is I'm being wheeled into surgery. At this point, I'm still wondering if they have the wrong chart, right? It doesn't help that the people who are working with me are asking me the same questions over and over and over again. I'm pretty sure you know these questions, so follow along here. What's your name? Could you please tell me your name? Give me your date of birth, please. Please tell me your date of birth. And in my case, which breast is it? And then, honestly, comes truly the most horrifying question of all. What are we doing here today? Really? I mean, did you wonder? Shouldn't they know what they're doing here today? But I just kept thinking, no, this isn't me. This is not me. You've got the wrong chart, right? Sometimes, after a decade, I still feel this way. They got the wrong chart. And even though each of us has our own experience, we have our own unique story about our experience of having a diagnosis of cancer, there are still some things that we can all relate to when we receive that diagnosis. Some of us feel like we've been betrayed by our bodies. We've done everything right. What happened? How can this happen? Our bodies have betrayed us. This reminds me of Suzanne, who I met in our early days of survivorship. For Suzanne, the biggest change was she believed that her life would go a certain way, and it didn't. She used to have confidence that she was in control. But she told me that getting cancer had taken away that confidence, and that despite all she had done to be healthy, she felt her body had betrayed her. But I want to also talk about that it's not just us as the patients who go through the terrors of dealing with the impact of cancer. There are those who've walked alongside us on the cancer trail, our partners, our family members. Your stories tell a tale of pain too. And oftentimes, that doesn't get heard. The stories like this one of a mother. She's the mother of a 17-year-old girl, and she can hardly put into words what she feels when her daughter gets a diagnosis of cancer. I mean, there she is, sitting unconcerned after being assured that the lump they'd found in her daughter's chest was 99% not cancer. So she's sitting unconcerned as the pulmonologist is talking to them. They're looking at x-rays, waiting for some benign diagnosis, when her daughter excuses herself and leaves the room for a moment. So mom turns to the doctor and asks him what he thought was going on. He replies, "She has cancer." So that moment, her daughter returns to the room, and this mother told me that I had about a million thoughts going through my head, and I was trying not to look devastated. I was trying not to look concerned, but of course I was completely devastated, and I'm sure that I failed miserably. And then there are our partners, those who are standing with us, so deeply affected, not knowing what to say, not knowing what to do. It feels unreal to you too, just as it does to us. My friend John told the story of when he first heard that his partner was diagnosed. He remembers feeling a total deflation, like when your brain and your body collapse and you're nothing but a heap of skin. And this feeling of disbelief comes over you that says, this isn't supposed to be happening. This isn't supposed to be happening, but it is happening. And it's happening to us. You know, many of us, we're not rich and famous when we get cancer. And while it would be amazing and awesome to step away in some beautiful natural setting like you see in the magazines and spend the entire time at the spa, you know, most of us, we're just trying to adjust our lives to the reality of combating a life-threatening illness. We're just trying to get through every day, pay our rent, pay our mortgage, make sure those kids don't go off the rails. You know, we're just trying to figure out what we're doing and how we're going to do it. As we begin the next leg of the grueling marathon that we're running and enter cancer treatment. You know how physically distressing cancer treatment can be. I never knew how painful it could be to have my long curls, yes, once upon a time, long curls fall off in clumps into the bathtub drain. "Let's take care of this," I said to my husband, who then became my barber. Red eyes, liquid drops that felt like fire going into my eyes. Mouth sores and that awful concoction that I really, honestly, I could not swallow it. I just held it in my mouth and tried not to throw it back up. Because we're so raw and we're so vulnerable when we're in treatment for cancer. Often we can go from feeling perfectly fine to being in a lot of pain, constantly and hideously nauseated from chemotherapy drugs, and even suffering radiation burns. My breast got so seared, I had to apply a cream that was made out of silver. To this day, I wondered if it was sterling silver, because you can imagine how much that cream cost. I think of those days as my Mrs. Potato Head days. I had no hair, I had no eyebrows, no eyelashes. I didn't have a hair on my entire body. The hair in my armpits never did grow back. Never had to shave again. That was one gift of cancer. But really, seriously, cancer treatment interrupts our lives. The plans we made, the direction we thought we're going, it changes in an instant. A girl that I know had to leave her high school classes, watch her friends move on with their plans for college while she was in treatment. She told me that the 7 months of chemotherapy were the most difficult of her life, and that chemotherapy was not just the treatment for her cancer, but that it had changed her both inside and out, and it left her feeling different from her peers. As a young person with cancer, she was really different from her peers. One moment, you think you're heading in one direction, and in the next moment, nope. Here's a story of a cancer diagnosis changing a life when a normal pregnancy is interrupted by a cancer diagnosis. This has a happy ending when the pregnant young woman who had gone through chemotherapy gave birth and brought her enormous, seriously enormous, baby boy in to see me. She'd felt him as her closest companion during her treatment for cancer. And when he was born, she said to me, "The first thing I did was to look to see if he had any hair." Well, this giant, feisty boy came into this world with a full head of gorgeous, dark curls. Our friends have their stories too. Often they feel helpless, and as friends, sometimes they feel left out, and they feel frightened. Imagine how this friend felt after getting off an airplane and walking right by the best friend that she didn't recognize. And she was shocked. She knew that her friend had lost her hair, but it still came as a whammy to see how small her friend had become, to see her in one of those little knit hats. She could still see the enthusiastic smile. The sparkle in the eyes was still there. But behind them, she saw weariness. She saw firsthand how hard her friend was fighting and how deeply tired she'd become. This cancer treatment is exhausting, yeah? And no one really tells you about the year or more it will take to recover and to heal and to find yourself again. As my friend and two-time cancer survivor Pam says, completing treatment for cancer doesn't just close that chapter on your life. I mean, you can't just dust off your hands and be done with it. The physical and the emotional trauma remain. But how do we move beyond it? How do we move forward from the storms of cancer? One way I know is by telling our stories. And so people say, well, what good does it do to talk about it? You know, how does that help anything when you talk about it? Well, because when we don't hold our pain and our trauma inside, we heal better. And when we allow ourselves to express our emotions, we feel better. By releasing the trauma of our past, we move more fully into our present and begin to let go of all that we have carried as we've gone through it. Don't kid yourself. This is really hard work. This may be the most difficult chapter you go through in your life. And we do go through chapters. We go through seasons, phases of survivorship, rather like the seasons, changing over time. They mark a beginning and an ending of where we've landed. The seasons of survivorship, named over 30 years ago by physician and cancer survivor Fitzhugh Mullen and revised by Robert Miller a decade ago, give us some way to understand some of the uncertain territory that we're traveling through. The first season, acute survivorship. This is the time of diagnosis. It's the initial treatment. It's a very intense, it's a very heightened time. There's a lot of structure. Some of the stories I just shared were from that first season of acute survivorship. And I imagine that some of you here may have had some memories of that time, those first moments. Some of your stories may have come into your mind as you listened. Well, then treatment ends. What a time of transition this is. It's another time that feels unreal. It feels scary. It feels uncertain. Every one of us faces challenges as we complete our treatment for cancer. And, you know, it's the weirdest time. You should feel happy. You don't. You should feel relieved. You don't. You should feel finished. You don't. And you know, even though it's good to be here, sometimes it doesn't feel all that good as we head into the next season, which is called extended survivorship. It's a time of watching, of waiting. There might be some celebration, but honestly, most of us are not that much in a party mood. Extended survivorship is the time of transition from treatment. You may be in remission, or you may be someone who is living with cancer as a chronic disease. Remember, in this extended survivorship, that you are in a place of huge transition. And I encourage you to give yourself a lot of room just to be, and to not push and shove yourself into some place where you really don't feel you are or where others want you to be. I had this interaction with a doctor even before I left the treatment room for the last time. Dr. M. Oh, well, 5 years from now, you're not going to remember this. Oh, I think I'm going to remember this 5 years from now. Dr. M laughs a little uncomfortably, a little nervous, you know. Says, well, 5 years maybe, but 20 years from now, you're not going to remember this. And I'm thinking, I'm trying to do the math. It's not my strong suit, 20 years. 20 years from now, I'm going to be 76. Or will I? Finishing treatment for cancer is kind of like falling off a mountain after your climbing rope has been cut. Well-meaning folks are cheering wildly, encouraging such a monumental event. Those who have been walking alongside the days, the weeks, and the months of the ordeal, you know, frankly, they are glad it's over, and they're really excited that life can return to normal. So as you plummet towards what some call returning to normal or the new normal, you realize that you are free falling into some primal place of uncertainty without any sense of where you are. You look up at the top of the cliff and see your doctors and your nurses. They're waving kindly, if not a bit tiredly, as they turn from you to face the next newly diagnosed patient. You're on your own. You hope you land in a safe spot. You might ask, where's my parachute? Well, I didn't get a parachute. No one handed me a map. No one installed a GPS when I left the treatment room for the last time. It was 6 a.m. and barely light because I had radiation at 5:30. I'm one of those people, I needed to work as best I could during my cancer treatment. So I didn't know quite what to do. The radiologist I'd just spent the last 5 weeks with turned from me to take the next patient, didn't even say goodbye to me. So I kind of stood there, oh, okay. So I got in my car. I drove to the nearest bakery. I purchased several pounds of pastries. And I drove home. Wow, I'm on my own here. Huh. What was that moment like for you? Now things aren't so clear. We don't have such a structured treatment plan anymore. Our appointments become more minimal. Expectations from others start to show up. You're okay now. It's over. Everything's good, right? Well, actually, you may just feel lost and alone and unsure about the next part of your life. And the aftermath of cancer is a very confusing time.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
Julie, a cancer survivor who was diagnosed as a very young woman, told me that when she finished, she felt both happy and scared. She was happy that it was over, but she was scared that her cancer would recur and no one would notice in time. She told me that it concerned her that the regular routine of blood tests and all that monitoring, it fell off just a bit too fast. And she felt like the explanations that were given to her were just a bit too vague. She said to me, "I mean, I had cancer, and now I'm supposed to walk out of here like I had a routine infection or something? Whew, am I okay? Am I okay? Can I dare to have hope for my life?" I want to tell you a story about Carmela, who was facing that challenge of finding hope in her life. She's a singer. She's a songwriter. She's working really hard to make it in a difficult business. She's right on the brink of making it. Audiences around the world are responding to her songs, to her words, her melodies. She's just a couple weeks away from her second tour when that sore throat that just wouldn't go away turns out to be epiglottal cancer. Yeah. So we would sit together, her speaking her story, I would listen. Sometimes she could hardly talk. She could hardly hold her head up. Sometimes she could only gag. But she kept speaking, and I kept listening. And because both of us enjoy a bit of the dark humor in times of distress, sometimes we could laugh. And other times, it was like a river of sorrow flowed through that room. But she told her story. And then she began moving on. She started therapy for her voice without any assurance that she would ever sing again. But she started. She went back in and sat in her studio, only for moments at a time, but she went back. She was starting the next phase of her survivorship, and she was finding a way that she could have hope. Because gradually, and not on any prescribed schedule, you know, you actually begin to feel like you just might have a life. Not every ache and pain is cancer. That pimple is just a pimple. And you enter the season of permanent survivorship. Again, gradually, where you do begin to feel as though your life has possibility. Cancer isn't always the first or the second thing on your mind. You may be in remission. You may have no symptoms. You may have no evidence of disease known as NED. You might be cancer-free, but not free of cancer. due to chronic, late emotional and physical issues. But mainly, cancer doesn't wake you up in the morning. It doesn't keep you from going to sleep at night. And cancer doesn't wake you up in the middle of the night anymore. But reminders do happen. And as the tale continues to be told, there will be milestones and anniversaries. There will be celebrations and there will be disappointments. And sometimes just a feeling of overwhelming relief that you're still around. When you arrive at these touch points and go through these checkpoints, thoughts and feelings may arise. Some moments that could be evocative are medical follow-up appointments. They can trigger anxiety and memories of your experience. It's like the smell of that infusion room, the lights in the hospital. Diagnostic tests and scans that can trigger anxieties and fears. Blood draws can evoke concerns. Aches, pains, fatigue, those odd, unexplainable symptoms can create doubt, some dread, you know, a lot of confusion. Wait a minute, have I had this pain for 2 weeks? Let's see. But if I call, will they think I'm being a hypochondriac? They'll think I'm too nervous, I'm too anxious. But if I don't call, and something really is there, then what will happen? And it's really confusing to know what to do about that. And exams will remind us of those first scans. That scan that showed something that it really should not have been there. The phone call we'll never forget. Old demons will rear their ugly heads in your mind and make for sweaty palms and scary doubts. And the wait for results will always, always seem endless. And that's all part of it. It's just part of it. But you know, at this point in my life, I am not at all convinced of permanency. Permanency is an illusion of control, and while we all in our heart of hearts want to attain control, we work hard at it, and I know I work hard at it, alas. So I add the term impermanent survivorship as a way to make real the whole theme of learning to live with uncertainty. Uncertainty can create fear for most of us. And living with uncertainty is one of the major concerns that we face as cancer survivors. Uncertainty comes disguised as obsessive fear or in those constant looks for finding some way, some guarantee, a guarantee that illness is not going to return. We swear at it. Yell at it, we run away from it because we are frightened of what we can't control. And because we can't control anything, certainty is a really dangerous illusion. Our thoughts and our feelings around uncertainty cannot be addressed by a PowerPoint presentation, a diet, an exercise program. Exploring the truth of uncertainty is a deeply personal process. Living with uncertainty may be your greatest challenge, as well as your most profound opportunity in the impact of having cancer. You know, you may be surprised at what might happen if you accept impermanence and begin to live with uncertainty. When did you feel like a cancer survivor? Or do you? Just to reflect for a moment on these different seasons and see where you might feel you are. Just sort of reflect inside. How many of you feel as though you're in acute survivorship, that first initial stage, the diagnosis and the treatment? Those of you in extended survivorship, transition from treatment. And permanent survivorship. Oh, I think, you know, I'm my head's back up. I think that it's going to be okay. And I wonder about those of you here who are living with cancer as a chronic disease. How many of you, like me, relate to impermanent survivorship and learning to live with uncertainty? But, you know, no matter where any of us are, it's always a transition. And again, I want to also acknowledge those of you who are a partner, a family member, a caregiver, those who are in relationship with someone who is walking on the cancer trail. You are survivors right alongside the rest of us. You have your stories too, and your stories are important and they need to be heard. Often you feel guilty for having your own needs and your own feelings, and you feel lost and isolated. I encourage those of you who are the other survivors to tell your stories and to find people who can witness what has happened for you. It's very, very important. But, you know, regardless of where any of us are in the seasons, at any moment, we're likely to hear a lot about the gift of cancer, right? I remember hearing about the gift of cancer even before I had cancer. Well, I'm someone that works with transformation. I believe in transformation, and I thought, wow, that has a certain ethereal elegance to it. I mean, people write books, they give speeches, they create foundations. Their stories are inspirational. They tell us stories of profound learning that lead to life changes. They're deeply moving. They were inspirational. And I thought to myself, well, yes, I mean, cancer is a horrible life-threatening disease, but for so many, it's a gift. It's a precious gift wrapped in a cloak of darkness. Well, when I was told that I had an aggressive metastatic breast cancer, my first thought was not, wow, thanks. I'm really thrilled with this gift. My husband was not excited either. We didn't open a bottle of champagne. We didn't dance around the room in wild elation. Nor were we excited to tell our then 14-year-old son the news. As an ordinary woman living an ordinary life, I just kept putting one foot in front of the other. I was hoping that my ordinary life, which suddenly seemed remarkably precious, would continue. And you know, I'm fortunate it did continue. And we do continue if we are fortunate as survivors. I heard the following lines many times during my experience with cancer, and I'm pretty sure you're familiar with them too. One, I know just how you feel. This is often followed by the person breaking into some hysterical crying jag while you don't know if you should comfort them or just run in the opposite direction. Two, oh, you're going to be fine. Well, really? How the hell do you know that? And then three, aren't you over this by now? This is often said 10, maybe 15 minutes after you finish treatment for cancer. And then there are those numerous stories told by friends or family members or a cousin of the butcher's doctor's son who have or had the same kind of cancer as you do, and they're still around after 15 years. Occasionally, someone shares a more dour tale of your friends, families, cousins, nieces, aunts died a terrible, terrible death. My all-time favorite, though, is, I know just how you feel. My dog had cancer. But it's really hard not to become part of someone else's story when you're so vulnerable, when you're struggling to find out who you are now that you are a person who's been diagnosed with cancer. But you are not your cancer. You're not your diagnosis. You are not your statistic. You were not given a gift that you wanted, yet through your suffering and your adversity, you have been given the authentic opportunity for transformation. There can be a genuine gift in the impact of having cancer. You have a unique story of cancer that will help make it possible for you to discover and build an inner GPS that you can trust to show you where you are, where you need to be, and where you want to be. You know, in life doesn't give us a preview of coming attractions. Our stories are written as we live them. And so I think it's important to be open to surprise. So let's flash back 4 years ago, and the little article that I've written on cancer survivor care has turned into a book proposal, and I'm heading to New York to find a publisher. And this is a really grueling journey, I can tell you. So it's early in the morning, and as we all stumble onto the plane, I see that the guy behind me, Randy, is a guy I know professionally. Well, I don't know him well, but I know that his wife has died of cancer. He's sitting right behind me. Oh, well, where are you going to New York City? Well, he has a group he goes to every year, and one of his best friends lives there, so he's really excited about going. I say, well, I've got this proposal, a book about cancer. Oh, the cancer conversation begins over the seats, and it deepens. He has had cancer. I have had cancer. And his wife has died of cancer. And he's very sad. He feels alone, and he doesn't know at this point if he might be alone for the rest of his life. He thinks my book is a good idea, and he looks forward to reading it, and then he naps. Well, so then the person who's been sitting next to me has overheard our conversation, and she introduces herself. Her name is Tatiana, and her sister has died of cancer. She is on her way to walk the Camino de Santiago in Spain in honor of her sister and for her own healing. She's wearing a beautiful scarf that she has made, and she's carrying small pieces of colored thread that she's tying onto this scarf. Each thread represents someone that she meets along the way. It represents their stories. It represents their healing. She will offer a small piece of thread to everyone that she encounters. She will carry half of the thread that they pick. The other half will stay with her fellow traveler, not on the Camino, but on their own pilgrimage. She offers to take me along, and I pick a small purple thread. It wasn't just a cancer conversation, it's a conversation of pilgrimage. The plane lands, and we all head in different directions. All three of us are on a journey of healing. We're just on different routes. Tatiana finished her walk, and we are still in contact on Facebook. Randy and I became friends. He sponsored my first cancer survivor retreat at a conference, and I supported him in his grieving. And then, unexpectedly, he fell in love again and is now happily married. Last year, when my husband suddenly died, Randy offered me some of the most encouraging words of all when he said to me, "Cheryl, if I were single, I would so pursue you and I would ask you out." I thought, wow, you know, maybe it is possible to find love again. And perhaps if we just hold on to that thread, we won't get lost. We can find our way through the darkness, through the illness, and through the suffering. And we find our way back to ourselves and heal so that we can begin the next chapters of our stories. One story ends and another begins. And on March 27th, 2017, a decade to the exact day of my cancer diagnosis, my book that grew out of terror and illness, confusion and uncertainty, is published. You have your own stories, and your stories matter. You did not create your cancer. It is not your fault that you drew the short straw. You can find authentic transformation in the darkness of your fears and sorrows. And you know, in the end, you may discover that you become more than you ever believed you can be. You're right. This isn't the story that you chose, but it's your story, and it's yours to tell. Thank you.
Thank you very much. If anybody has filled out a question card, I'll be happy to read it to the speaker. If not, I want to thank you for an absolutely wonderful presentation, and I believe you'll be available if people... Did you have a question?
So I'm a therapist, and I am not a cancer survivor, but mm-hmm. I'm speaking at a conference of a group of people who have cancer. Patients, newly diagnosed, a few years after diagnosis, mm-hmm. their caregivers, their partners. Mm-hmm. What would be the one thing that you would, encourage me to talk about?
One thing is, you've got some different groups there. So the one thing I might first acknowledge is that there's going to be, that everyone there is in a place of either survivorship or distress themselves, and that everyone is going to have their own unique story to tell. That would be, I think, the first thing that I would suggest. And the other thing, pardon me, and I do talk about this a bit, I think it's very, very significant to tell people that, you know, it's not their fault, they didn't create this. There's such a tyranny, particularly in the world of cancer, that you don't find in other, even horrible, horrible life-threatening diseases. You know, you don't hear people with heart attacks, oh, you should be positive, you should think better, you know, you get sick if you don't think better. So I would really make sure that they feel like it's normal to have all the feelings that they have. Earlier studies of the emotional trauma of cancer were often skewed to show, oh, these are people that are anxious, they're depressed, as though they pathologized the trauma of having a life-threatening illness. And I feel very passionate about not pathologizing somebody for an obvious trauma. And so just kind of opening it up, and I don't know what if you'll have chance for people to talk, but what usually happens is that once people start to talk, they just have so much they need to talk about, and so much just to disclose, you know. So, yeah. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. How does the content of your talk tonight apply to other serious illness, or is it, or is cancer unique?
Uh-huh. Well, I've gotten some lovely feedback from people who have told me that they are using my book for different kinds of illnesses. I know one person is using my book, particularly the workbook section, for a daughter who's had some serious issues with addiction and has now gone back into that. So living with uncertainty is, of course, what all of us as human beings, we struggle with. Anytime an illness comes on, it kind of ups the ante. It's like, well, it's not a theory anymore. You know, we're talking about something that's really uncertain. So I would say that, I mean, I hope that it can be helpful to people who just need to process what it's like for them when they have to deal with a life-threatening illness. So I don't think it's just about cancer. It was written from that perspective because of my own experience, but I don't think it's narrowed to that. So.
Okay, we have a few more questions.
Okay.
Do you know of any resources similar to your book for pre-adolescent survivors?
Boy, you know, not right offhand, but I'm glad if that person wants to give me their contact information, because I'm a member of an organization called the American Psychosocial Oncology Society, and there's whole groups of people there who specialize in adolescents, youth, you know, YA, young people. And so I'd be glad if I have that information to get some resources. It's not something I deal with, so I can't. And I don't like to give resources that I don't know personally, that I don't really know that they're useful. Because sometimes if you contact a larger cancer organization, they don't call you back. You know, they don't get back to you, things like that. It's too big. So, but I'd be glad to see if I could get some resources.
Okay. And another question for you. What ideas or advice or thoughts can you share for preparing for treatment and dialogues with the doctors?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, the first thing that comes to my mind is to really take care of yourself and to sort of, again, like in the survivorship phase, to give yourself a lot of room and not push and shove where you are at that given moment, and to not let yourself be pathologized. I have in this book that I've written a whole list of questions that I feel are important to talk to your doctor about, and it's oriented towards you bring them in and you have them right at your, you know, at your fingertips, so that you can have a working relationship with your doctor. When I work with people, I always strongly encourage them to speak their own minds, to be assertive, to ask questions, and to really, you know, not take no for an answer. And by the way, I'm not meaning to disrespect the physicians. I think it's a working relationship, and so we need to have a mutual respect. Them for us and us for them. So it goes both ways, right? So I think there are some very important questions that, again, on the checklist, be long to go all through them right now, but ask them.
Okay.
Ask them.
And we have time for one more, and it's, I think you'll like it.
Oh.
Cheryl, you said that you were an ordinary woman. I beg to differ. You're an extraordinary. After my first diagnosis, working with you was the most powerful tool I had to find my way through the darkness. Unfortunately, my cancer came back. Would you speak a little bit about the emotional experience of recurrence?
Yeah. Well, I think you probably could better than me. But I think that, you know, it's such a shadowy disease. I think that is what differs, you know, cancer differs from other diseases. It's such a shadowy disease. It never goes away. It's always there. There is no cure for cancer, whatever anybody says. And I'm glad the researchers are working on it, and I hope tirelessly. But it is a shadow that you live with. And when that shadow returns, it's like a whammy. And so I think that it's important to, in a way, just start to, okay, here I am again, and be present with it. And just to say, well, and now and this, and now and this, and how present you can be just with the moments as you have to live them, you know.
Okay. All right, thank you. Unfortunately, we are out of time. I want to thank you very much, Ms. Crowder, and I thank all of you for joining us today. I believe you'll be available if people have some individual questions. And by the way, I've read your book. It's excellent.
Oh, thank you.
And it is for sale out there, and I believe you would be willing to sign the copies
sure.
as well. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Patrick. I really appreciate it. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for being here.
Sure.
Thank you.